Archie.
Yeah?
I have a magic trick.
Oh, no.
Yes, I want to show you a magic trick because you tied me down and hit me in the face a couple of weeks ago.
Well, I'm on to you, and this had better be good.
Yes, it's a good magic trick.
What is that? Is that a hat?
Yes, it's Mama's top hat.
Okay.
And I make a magic pass over it.
Yeah.
And presto, reach inside.
What the hell is this? A piece of paper?
It's a restraining order telling you to stay away from me.
Aw, damn it.
This is part 3 of the Once and Future Thing with special guests Jonathan Pendragon and Wes McDonough. Jonathan, you were mentioning The Man Who Smiles.
I've never actually seen it, you know. Yeah. I know, of course, that was the inspiration for the Joker's physical appearance,
yeah.
But
yeah.
Not the character that, you know. It's a very tragic film.
Yeah, yeah. Gwynplaine, yeah. The man who...
What's the name of the actor that played?
Conrad Bett.
Conrad Bett, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Conrad Bett or Veet or however it's pronounced, but it's a... Amazing story, yeah.
I saw a reference to it in the picture. I said that had to be, before I looked it up, I said that has to be where they got the physical appearance for the Joker.
Oh, absolutely.
And then, of course, I looked it up, and sure enough, The Man Who Smiles was interesting.
Yeah, the Joker's an amazing character, and I feel lucky to have written some stories about him and contributed a little bit to his ongoing legacy.
You contributed to his girlfriend.
Yeah. We were driving by this down here in Los Angeles and on Cahuenga Boulevard. Warner Brothers Studios has an enormous mural of all of their cartoon characters, and it looks like they're bursting out of the building. So Superman is in the center, and Batman, Wonder Woman, and they're all there.
Right.
And at night, they go dark, and the villains come up, and the villains are lighted. And the very first time we drove by, he drove by very slow, and he was looking, and he goes, "Oh my God." And there she was. Harley Quinn is up there.
Harley Quinn, the Joker, Clayface,
Catwoman.
Yeah, that's the first thing when I had met you a couple of times, but I had not met Paul, and we were all going to go out to dinner together. And he was so. He says, "He created Harley Quinn." That was all he would say about Paul. He created Harley Quinn.
Yeah.
I love the character. I mean, because you look at Catwoman.
No, it's like you don't get.
She's
this.
An interesting
he created
character,
Harley
but there's
Quinn.
But none of Batman really has, you know, in even. Ra's al Ghul's daughter,
Talia,
he doesn't have any really psychotic female, I mean, at least they're not popular, any female
well,
villains.
Well, Poison Ivy has made it into the movie, you know.
That's true, Poison Ivy.
But there's something about Harley that she's more innocent than the other two. She's not the man-crushing femme fatale that Poison Ivy is, and she doesn't have the evil stigma that Catwoman does, even though Catwoman's more of an ally character. She's sort of...
She's not doing anything for malice. She's doing it to impress her boyfriend.
And she's just doing it for fun, you know? It's sort of like I'm into it because being a criminal in Gotham City is sort of this weird performance art. And, you know, okay.
Well,
people...
and she does everything in a big, gaggy way, too.
Yeah.
She's got the guns that say bang, just like they bought their stuff in an evil gag store.
Yeah,
a giant
people
mallet
get hurt, but, you know, I've got to break some eggs, you know? It's their fault they got hurt. I didn't really do anything. I just set off the bomb. If they shouldn't have been walking there. That's her attitude. And I don't know. I think people just like they love the Poison Ivy Harley dynamic, the Joker Harley dynamic, and
You were actually, and maybe we should touch on this a little bit. We were talking about the Poison Ivy and Harley dynamic a little bit this weekend.
Yeah.
And about how people have alluded to you on Twitter. They have asked, "Is it sapphic? You know, are they lesbians?" In this iteration, in your specific version of that, and you were explaining to me that no, that it's actually a very maternal relationship because Poison Ivy is dangerous. Harley gravitates towards those kind of people because they find that rock of stability.
Yeah.
And I'm talking, and you should be. So I'm going
to
stop.
Well, it's just a personal thing, but it's hard for me to kind of sexualize cartoon characters and think of them in that, you know, having that life.
Well, there
are
other people that do not have that problem. So, for all those people drawing the weirdo fan art, not
easier,
that we're judging you, but we are.
Well, I don't know. At least within the context of the show it was, and maybe that's because it was a show where traditionally those elements aren't dealt with. But, you know, if I'm writing a short story or a movie or something, it doesn't have any problems getting into that. But with Harley and Ivy, I think, you know, well, I've written them enough in the comics. Yeah, I think there's an element of that to it. I just think that there's an element of...
An element of what to it?
I think there can be an element of sexuality to it, but there's more an element
like
of...
that they were having a sexual relationship?
It's not what it's about in the beginning. It's mostly, it's about being... gravitating to the strongest personality in the room. You know,
right.
Harley should...
Which she has a natural proclivity psychologically profiling her toward doing.
Right, right. And
because she is a very please love me kind of character.
Right. And I think when Harley goes into a room, you know, or, you know, she gravitates toward the strongest personality there. It's usually the Joker or somebody. So she loves the Joker for these, you know, reasons because she got into his head and shared things with her that he never told anybody else. Or, you know, so she believes. And, you know, maybe he did put an aspect of that, he told her about an aspect of himself that he never told anybody else or that she picked up on a subtext. For whatever reason, she's got a very real bond with him. And when he's not around, she tends to gravitate toward the next strongest person. And that's usually Poison Ivy, because Ivy is a total hedonist. She's very selfish. She's very self-aware. She's very determined, and she gets what she wants, and mm-hmm. she doesn't let anybody stand in her way. So Harley gravitates to that, and I think it takes more it takes on more of an element of friendship, of sisterhood, of
and admiration.
But I also think, you know, there have been times we've played around with the idea. Maybe they, you know, sleep together in the same bed. Maybe they've experimented a little bit, but it's not really where it's about. First and foremost, I mean, the joke...
That is totally not what you told me this weekend at all. Well, it's really interesting to hear you shift perspective. I'm not saying it's right or wrong. I just think it's really interesting.
I mean, I don't think it's about that, you know, entirely. But I don't... It's more about the other thing. It's more about gravitating to someone's personality. Because I don't think of Ivy as having any particular sexuality. I think that she's... You know, she's not straight or bi or gay. She's
above that because she's just manipulative.
Kind of quad or quint or, you know, she's you know.
Omni.
Yeah.
Yeah,
she's,
Omni. There you go.
Yeah, she's kind of like this perversion of Mother Earth, you know, so.
She's an omnivert.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, omnivert. That's perfect. Plant, animal, mineral, she's attracted to it all. She's a total sensualist and hedonist.
Sort of a Captain Jack Harkness.
There you go.
And Harley is kind of her touchstone to her humanity because she almost thinks of Harley as sort of like a little bit of a pal, a little bit of a pet, a little bit of a helper, you know? Mm-hmm. But somebody, even Poison Ivy has human moments where she just needs someone to talk to or just, you know, just needs somebody to be with her. And here's this girl who's willing and happy, and maybe she brings out something in Ivy that, you know, Ivy would, you know, have to, you know... do without, because Ivy's, you know, pretty much a loner, despite the fact that she's never wanted for male companionship or female companionship for that matter. She's just, for whatever reason, Harley was the one that kind of got under the defenses, simply because Harley was willing to be whatever Ivy wanted her to be at the time, and Ivy found that agreeable. So
it's funny that sexuality is so altered by time. Then you look at when Sherlock Holmes was written, the idea of two bachelors living together was so completely normal. No one ever, there was never any idea of a sexual intimacy between Holmes and Watson was never explored.
Yeah.
Until about 20 years ago, 25 years ago. Mm-hmm. No one ever thought of it because that was in the norm.
But there and was, it's a running gag now in the BBC, the new BBC version.
Right, now it is a running gag.
Yeah.
It never used to be, no one ever used to even think about it because it wasn't that... abnormal.
The first time it ever came up that I recall was in The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, where it's sort of alluded to, but almost as a joke, as sort of like Holmes says it to sort of
escape a situation.
Right. Yeah, exactly. But it's never they don't dwell on it. It's just that Holmes offers it up to get him out of a tight situation.
Yeah, and then Watson makes a big deal about it, and then Holmes looks at him like, oh, come on. And Watson then realizes how ridiculous any such. But it's again, they were, you know, the private life of Sherlock Holmes. It's interesting that Irene Adler is such an influence in the movies. Although she only appears in The Scandal in Bohemia in the books, the only time she ever appears. But
yeah.
She's referenced in two
a
of the other
of
stories.
Others, yeah.
In short stories. But there's aspects of her in 7% Solution, in The Private Life of Sherlock Holmes, mm-hmm. in Sherlock Holmes in New York,
sure.
and in the two Robert Downey Jr. films.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I mean, this, you know, the woman, as mm-hmm. Holmes called her, is as although a very small footprint in the actual novels or short stories, is gigantic in the cinema in the cinema history of Sherlock Holmes.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, it just to me that's why. Yeah, defining Poison Ivy and Harley Quinn as sort of as a purely sexual relationship doesn't work for me because it is so much more than it's not as interesting to me as the codependency than the mm-hmm. mental state that would attract, you know, a person who's lacking with certain strengths to someone who's very strong and very secure in who they are. And then anything else is just sort of kind of off to the side. But that's the thing about literature is that you've got a strong character in Holmes who's strong and cerebral and just does not function in that other, in the romantic arena. And I don't see any reason to make him do that. It's not part of what the creator...
Well, it's such a convention in yeah. movies that you've got to have a romantic interest in there, or you're not going to get the audiences, which is why it keeps popping up there.
Right.
I love the... you're going to probably know it better than I. The Julie Newmar line in the old TV show when Batman and Catwoman are getting really, really close and they're considering a possible relationship. And then, you know, I can't remember who brings it up, but someone brings up Robin and then Catwoman goes, well, we can just knock him off.
Yeah, right, yeah.
And it's a funny, it's just such a, you know.
I saw some of those recently and yeah, she really, I'd forgotten that they really do get romantic in those.
Oh, yeah.
In those and,
oh, they were making you mad.
What?
Oh, what's he doing? Batman doesn't sing.
Oh, yeah,
and
that's right.
And I
looked
at Paul making... because I don't know if you guys know, but Paul actually wrote an episode of a cartoon in which Batman does, in fact, yeah. sing. And so when he was carrying on, first of all, he was angry because there were rudimentary things and he was yelling, Superman would never fall for this shit. What's the matter with him?
Yeah, I know.
And then he says, and Batman doesn't sing because he had to sing a perfect F or something to get out of this glass case that he was in to shatter the glass.
And you said, he has.
And I said, he has. And I leaned over and said, Am I Blue? Which is a song that he had Batman sing. And Paul said, oh, damn it. And then he was mad about that.
Yeah,
but
you were
getting furious over that show.
But there's no indication he did it on key.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, but the two...
Uncle Batman?
Oh, Uncle Batman!
Uncle Batman.
This is a fine time to talk about
I've told Batman. The Uncle Batman story before.
I know. Ezra hasn't heard it, which
I believe
means
I've
no
I've told the Uncle Batman story.
And I know Jonathan's never heard it.
I've never heard it.
Okay, all right. Okay, well, this one's for you, Adam West, if you're out there listening. Uncle Batman.
well, I've already given the punchline.
Years ago, I was at Dragon Con. In fact, this may be at the Dragon Con.
That where, I didn't go to.
Well, it was probably the Dragon Con where my dad called me up and told me about my... My prep school buddy, yeah, who got killed in a hunting
Please tell
accident.
Us how Beach Ball passed away.
I'm not going to tell how Beach Ball passed. Should I tell that story?
Okay. You know what? Just very quickly, because it's cool.
I had a friend who...
It's not cool that he passed away at all.
Okay, I'm at Dragon Con, and I get a call from my dad, and he's calling me on the hotel, you know, phone, and it's like, wow, dad never calls me when I'm on a trip, you know? It's even though he can... Mm-hmm. You know, it's just, it's kind of
old
fashioned.
Might as well wait until you get back.
Yeah, it's old fashioned thing.
This is abnormal.
I'm out of town. Here's where I'll be if there's an emergency.
Sure.
Then the emergency line rings. It's like, what's up? And I'm going like, well, Paul, I have some bad news. And I'm going like, oh, someone's dead. Oh, God, I hope it's not Mom. I hope it's not one of my siblings. You know, it's like, and he says, well, your friend from high school, Steve, was killed in a hunting accident. And I said, oh, that is sad. But you know,
he was hunting with Dick Cheney?
What?
No, he would have just been shot in the face.
Okay.
My dad and my assorted other family members belonged to a club in San Francisco called the Bohemian Club. And a lot of the kids I went to prep school with belong to this club as well.
I've been to...
You're a member, aren't you?
The Grove.
No, I'm a camp counselor. That's a joke. But it's...
You've been to the Bohemian Grove?
Oh, I'm up for associate membership. Actually.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well,
Patrick Martin, who's a good friend of mine, is a magician, is a member, and so is Frank Olivier, the juggler.
Ooh.
But you know, the Bohemian Club was one of the founding members was Mark Twain.
What's that?
Mark Twain. So I've been to Bohemian Grove several times.
Yes.
And I've actually worked on productions there.
This will probably brand me as a rabid Republican to all our listeners, but my summer for many years was. Bohemian Grove in the middle of July, and then Comic-Con the week after. So you talk about going from one extreme to another.
So what happened to Beach Ball?
He was hunting in New Zealand, and he shot at a trophy mountain goat, went up to collect the trophy, and it got up and hit him.
And knocked him off the mountain.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
So,
the revenge of the prey.
That's how I understand it. And I thought, well, that's unfortunate.
That's
and
how I'm going.
What, by mountain goat?
Mountain goat, butted off the mountain by a goat, man. That is the way to go.
I don't know, it seems.
Someone had to take it out, like,
well,
when he died.
He had gone around the world. You know, he's a big game hunter. And
that seems like a very karmically cool way to die.
Yes, you know? Exactly.
Yeah.
It is. But also, you're saying he's a big game hunter, so it's like he couldn't be taken out by a rhino or a tiger or something.
Well,
like
that's sort of the irony.
By a mountain goat.
Okay. Yeah,
I like this.
We would go shooting during the summer at the Grove, and we'd shoot traps, and he'd keep me up today. On what he had hunted recently, like. I got an elephant, I got a polar bear, I got this.
And he used to shoot with a camera.
He used to shoot with a camera when we were in prep school, and he was a really good nature photographer. And then he realized, you know, hey, these things are
fun to kill.
Kind of cool if they're hanging up stuff.
I kill them and stuff it. I could take as many pictures as I want.
There you go. There you go. So, ironically, that was an early summer. Later that year, I found myself on running for my life on a tiny little island called Rinka from a Komodo dragon. And I believe I've told that story.
Yes, you have.
And
but then you found yourself at Dragon Con on a panel.
Oh, yes. But I just want to finish up the story. And then I imagined, as I was going to get killed by the dragon, meeting up with my friend in the hereafter, probably hell for hunters, and saying, like, mountain goat, oh, I got done in by a Komodo dragon.
Nice.
Did you, you outran it?
He did.
Jumped into a boat.
That's very, very rare because they really run fast.
Oh, and this thing sprang at me as soon as I jumped in the boat. It was out for some.
A lot of people get killed. They don't realize that, you know, how fast they run and how dangerous they are.
Oh yeah, it was Indiana Jones time.
It's a 9-footer.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he's still got a knee injury from it.
Yeah, I actually screwed up.
Like a Jonathan story.
I screwed up my right knee, and to this day, when I'm tired, you know, this happened in 97. And so after that, like if I would work late at Warner Brothers or something and I'd be walking through the halls, my limp would come out and people would say, why are you limping? And I'd say, I have a limp. A giant lizard fucked up my leg. You know, it didn't bite it. but I, you know, jumping out of it and jumped, you know, knee first into a boat, it's sort of hard to come back from
in a water full of poisonous jellyfish.
Yeah.
Well, Wes has been there. Whenever I have to go in for a physical... Uh-huh. And Wes was there once when the doctor looks at and goes, what's that?
Oh, he loves the part where he has to give his medical history.
Oh, it's fabulous. What's that scarf?
Yeah, what's that scarf?
A tiger.
That was a Bengal tiger attacked my arm. And what's that scar? Oh, I was hit in the leg by a shark surfing in Australia. What's that scar? Well, an arrow went through my heart. And I'm going, they're not going to believe
and
this
my
stuff.
Diaphragm and my liver.
Yeah, I hit my liver, diaphragm, and heart. So.
Yeah, when he gets to the questions of, you know, have you ever had any surgeries, you know?
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, well, where do we start?
A few.
It's scary.
A wrap up to the Komodo dragon story is that at the end of the summer, I had a meeting with Steven Spielberg, and we were talking, and I said, hey, I was on the real Jurassic Park, you know, running, and I told him the Komodo dragon, and he says, well, that's a good story, but I got to tell you, I was in London around the same time, and I had to outrun the Spice Girls, and if you want to talk about reptiles, and if you want to talk about reptiles with an infectious bite,
that's okay.
Speaking of dragons, you were on a panel at Dragon Con.
I was on a panel at Dragon Con. Here we go back to that.
Adam West.
It was a Batman panel, and for whatever reason, I'm the Batman guest, one of the Batman guests, and the Batman guests are myself, Julie Schwartz, who was the editor emeritus at DC Comics, now unfortunately deceased, but a grand old guy of comics. Mm-hmm. And Yvonne Craig, who played Batgirl. And
Great costume.
Yes, and Adam West. And scheduled...
By the way, just really quick, I met Julie Newmar at Dragon Con, and she's a huge fan of yours, Jonathan Pendragon.
Really?
Yes.
It's funny, because I'm a good friend of Yvonne Craig.
You just made his day.
Oh, yeah. My God. I love Julie Newmar.
Yeah, and she asked me when she found out I was a magician if I knew you, and I had just met you at that time.
Oh my God.
I said, as a matter of fact, I just met him, and I'm working with him in about a couple weeks here, and she was like, oh, my God, please tell him that I just love his work.
Oh, that's very sweet.
So there you
I'm
go.
Glad you told him so promptly.
Oh, I love
what?
I'm glad yeah. you told him so promptly.
And many years later, you.
Oh, yeah,
no, but it's just it's cool because I, you know.
I never occurred to me, you know. It's...
Julie Newmar was one of the few reasons I actually watched the original.
Of course.
TV show.
The reason She's the anybody reason watched I still watch.
Yeah, I know.
All right, so you're on this panel and that Julie Newmar's not on it.
No, and Frank Gorshin was
some other chick.
Frank Gorshin was actually supposed to be on the panel, but he wasn't feeling well. But he appeared later at the convention when he felt better. So anyway, we're up there. It's the four of us at this panel. And we're taking questions. And I'm going like, I'm sitting on a panel with Julie Schwartz, who's written more comics than I'll ever write in my life, than I'll ever read in my life. And Yvonne Craig, Batgirl, and Batman. And this is so cool. I'm just going to sit here and say nothing because I don't want to screw up. I don't want anybody to notice me. You know, I'm just happy to be here. And somebody asks the inevitable question. And Adam and I had worked together very briefly on an episode of the animated series called
Beware
the Gray Ghost, where he played the TV hero that inspired
right. I remember
Batman.
That one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of fun and everything. He was terrific. But somebody asks the inevitable question, Adam, when are they going to put you in a live-action Batman movie? When is somebody at Warner's going to put you in a live-action Batman movie? And I'm kind of going like, oh, crap, here it comes. I'm the guy from Warner Brothers, so I'm going to get it. And he goes, well, I don't know. Paul, when is that going to happen? And everybody goes, yeah, when's that going to happen? And everybody's applauding, and I kind of shrink and go, oh, shit. You know, I can't make this happen, and I don't know what to say. And, you know, I'm not controlling the Batman movies. And he goes, well, and Adam says, well, you know what? I actually have a treatment that I've been working on called Uncle Batman. And I would like somebody at Warner Brothers, maybe you, Paul, and this hand goes down and kind of like a vice-like clamp on my shoulder and stays there for the rest of the panel. Maybe you could tell them about it. And it's like, maybe I could. What? Yeah, what's it about? And
stop
then,
touching me.
And then it's like, would you like to hear it? And everybody, of course they want to hear it. And he goes, well, it's Gotham City and it's all dark and it's a terrible time, and Batman, we have whoever's playing Batman at the moment is playing Batman, and he's getting, all the villains are out, and they're causing all sorts of trouble for him, and he's just about ready to give it up, and he's about to, you know, hang up his cape and cowl forever, because he just can't go on. There's no Robin anymore, there's no Alfred, he's older, and he's lost all faith, and there's got to be someone who can re-inspire him. And then he remembers, he's got one last living relative, Uncle Batman.
That's
and
right.
He turns to Uncle Batman.
Hell yeah, he does. Because we all turn to Uncle Batman
yes.
eventually.
And I think in Adam's pitch, it was sort of like Bruce's father, Thomas Wayne had a brother who was a crime fighter years before, who maybe was the first Batman or inspired Bruce in some way. So he goes to his uncle, and of course it's Adam as the uncle.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, well, you've got the modern Batman in his costume, but he doesn't have any gadgets because they were blown up by the Riddler or whoever. But Uncle Batman comes out of retirement wearing the old costume and and bringing the Batmobile, and they both get it, and they go driving off to save Gotham. Who wouldn't want to see that movie? And everybody in the crowd is cheering and applauding.
Yeah.
And, it's like, and I want to see that movie too, but now suddenly it's my responsibility. He goes, you, Paul, take that back and tell Warner Brothers this
oh
is what we
God.
Want to make. It's like, oh, I'll do that.
Tell yeah. Warner
do you know
Brothers
what
my
that,
story.
You know what that reminds me of?
What?
Billy West's story about Grandpa Munster.
Oh, Grandpa Munster. That's great. Yeah, I mean,
well, which is very, just very briefly, he was off shooting a movie years after the Munsters were over,
mm-hmm.
and Billy West does a spot-on impression
yeah.
of him, by the way, and he says, "Yeah, I've been working on this movie for a long time, and they just won't take my recommendation for the movie." And he said, "Well, what is your recommendation for the movie's title?" And he says, "They're calling it the Vampire of These Lanes," and he goes, "But here's my idea, we call it Grampire."
Yeah, starring me, Grandpa Munster, as Grampire.
And Billy was like, oh boy.
Yeah.
Okay.
Billy West, that was a night he was
channeling him.
He was channeling Al Lewis as Grandpa Munster, and nobody does a funnier, even Al Lewis didn't do a funnier Grandpa Munster than Billy West. He was like, yeah, we're going to do Grampire. It's going to be great.
It's hysterical.
And he was doing them all night, and then we got home, and then like we're watching the late news, and it's like, Earlier today, comedian Al Lewis passed away in New York. And it's like,
oh
my God.
And possessed Billy West at our dinner. Yeah. I mean, like, at the moment, Billy was doing it. Yeah. Wow. It was, like, really, really weird. It was eerie.
I passed through him before I went off to the big Catskills in the sky.
I think a lot of Catskills comedians do that. Billy West, stop off.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So there was, he does them all.
But that was the Uncle Batman story. I mean, I think it's fun. I mean, if they were about, if the Batman movies were about fun, I could see them doing that.
Did you pass the idea?
You know what? I told people around the studio. I didn't make a formal pitch because I didn't think I don't.
What
think
wasn't
I could
your project to pitch really?
It wasn't really.
You know,
I don't
if
think
they were
I could
interested, they could find him. You told them where to find it.
Yeah.
They didn't follow up on that, but you did do due diligence. You did what you said you were going to do.
I don't have quite as much pull as people would think with the front offices at that time. I did work on a Batman movie on several pitches. For Batman movies and some that nobody, you know, few people outside this room know about, but, you know, as far as writing one of the movies, that didn't really, or at least one that got filmed, that didn't really materialize.
Well, I mean, you've worked on series for Harley and Ivy, too.
Yeah.
That didn't go very far, because they said, oh, that's too
risque.
Do you think someone would accept a much more cerebral Batman as a film, or does it always have to be the actor? I mean, Bale's gotten about as close...
Yeah,
as we've ever come to that to that side of Batman, but even there, you know, he's got, you know, Fox doing half the work, maybe more than half the work as far as the gadgetry.
Yeah. I don't know. You know, the thing is that Batman is such an odd, well, not just Batman, but any character that has that comes with that whole history has so much attached to it that it's almost like. It's like riding a vehicle for a major star, and there's so much connected to it that I really don't want to get on that horse again because it's with the amount of effort that I put in trying to make all the myriad of people happy, I would be doing a better job making myself happy and creating something new and trying to set it up someplace else.
I think that's what really attracted me to the new Doctor Who because in the old ones, you know, it was always about his adventures and... You know, there was not a lot of depth to the characters. Some of them were more intellectual than others. But what Tennant brought to it and what they started writing scripts around, because the guy is a phenomenal actor, is he starts showing the angst that, you know, one, this guy travels through history forever.
Yeah.
And he can never have a real partner because, you know, he's going to watch them grow old.
Yeah.
And well, two, Davies and then Moffat as the showrunners.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, really brought, you know, that whole... element to it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And all of a sudden, it's like, this is like incredible because, I mean, I love those storylines, you know, where you got to, you know, there was one called, one of my favorite pieces of television, period.
The Family of Blood?
Family of Blood, yeah. Where he has to, this family of kind of like vampire like creatures, although they're not really vampires, but sort of that in that genre, but they're trying to destroy all of the earth by, you know, and he's got to punish them at the very end.
Mm-hmm.
And he punishes the, you know, they want to live eternally. And his, all of his punishments have the idea of eternity in them, but they're rather cruel. And you see Tennant have to do this because he is the Time Lord. He is protecting the timeline. He's protecting a civilization from being destroyed. And he has to make this choice. And he has to do it alone.
Mm.
And just the pain he goes through was like, oh my God. You know, there was, you know, yes, there's consequences for my actions.
Mm.
I'm not a mindless person. I'm not a mindless hero. And so to see that part of his soul was so wonderful. I mean, it was just, you know, it just, I mean, I turned, when Wes and I watched, it was a two-part, and Wes and I watched it together. And I turned to her and I said, that's some of the greatest television I've ever seen. Because they gave a great science fiction character depth.
Yeah.
My God, who would think of that, you know?
Well, I think that really, you need that in great science fiction or fantasy characters or great children's characters. Either it just, there has to be a little bit of the bitter, not a lot, but with the sweet. If you take out every bit of sweetness, I mean, if you just take out every bit of sadness and you've just left with sweetness, then the character just doesn't live anymore for me.
Willy Wonka, perfect example.
Yeah, yeah.
When you look at the different portrayal, we look at Gene Wilder's portrayal and then Johnny Depp's. Johnny Depp's was actually a little bit closer to, I can never pronounce his name. Somebody else pronounce it for me, please.
Dahl.
No, that one I can get. It's the first name.
Roald Dahl.
You know, that's one I can never.
Roald Dahl.
Yeah, that there is
one of the greats of children's fiction.
Yeah, there is. You know, Willy Wonka is a very complex character, and you know,
and also very lonely.
And very lonely. Yeah, and it's why we gravitate towards him. It makes him interesting.
You know, Peter Pan. For all the fun of the books, Peter Pan works for me. When he's that lonely boy listening at the window to people tell stories about him, or when he sees that there's another child in his place in the nursery, and when he knows that he can't go in and hear the stories, you know, from a real mother. And, you know, you need that. You need the idea that you know, Christopher Robin is going to grow up someday real soon and leave his friends in the Hundred Acre Wood. And to distill that out of it, because
they touched on that with Andy in Toy Story.
Yeah. Oh, and again, that's why those movies are so good. Mm-hmm.
That to me is always the thing that reason I don't care for the classic Superman. I know they've played around with it more since then, but he was always the epitome of the perfect Boy Scout who never did anything,
right?
You know, even remotely dark or twisted in any way. There was no hesitation about it. It was just.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean,
and that's boring.
Yeah, there has to be an element of sweet sadness with fantasy characters to ground them a little bit, because without it, you know, I mean, you know, you just have those Tinkerbell movies where she's just, I'm insecure because the other girl fairies laugh at me. It's like, well.
Or her wings sparkle, I think, in this new one that they do.
Oh, is that right?
It's something like that. She's got 12 wings, and it's embarrassing.
Okay.
What, did they take that from the Twilight stuff? Or?
I don't know. I think that's what they do, though. It's like, oh, my wings sparkle. And oh, jingles is their swear word. Oh, jingles.
Oh, jingles.
That's the swear word. Remember, I was trying to remember that sparkles.
Yeah. I'm thankful to say I am unfamiliar with this particular.
Yeah, I only know them because.
Opus of which you speak.
Yeah, I auditioned for a couple of them.
Okay.
You know, this is all stuff that's out already. This is not new.
But even, you know. Even Captain scripting. Hook in the books, you know, he's like, you know, no child loves Captain Hook. You know, he broods over that. You know, everybody loves Peter Pan. They love the Indians. Mm-hmm. They love everybody else. They don't love him. And he's sad about that.
Well, I like him.
Crocodile liked him, too.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think that, you know.
Tick-tock.
Uh-huh.
You need a little of that. That's what I said. And when that gets taken out because somebody who is not connected with the project says, oh, you know, well, we've got to tie in with this toy company, and we have to keep it bright and sunny. We don't want the kids thinking about that. It loses a lot.
It does.
Because
a lot of those elements, you know, like the elementary fairy tales, the Grimm's fairy tales and all that stuff, they were deliberately passed down to teach lessons.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of them are coming of age stories.
They were dark.
Yeah, oh, sure. They're really dark. And a lot of them are coming of age stories. You go into the forest and you gain knowledge. And that's, you know, it's an allegory for growing up and gaining maturity and experiencing dark times of brooding thought in life and
Harry
giving
Potter.
Kids permission to be scared and to tell them what to be scared of.
Yeah.
One of the ancient Hindu texts is a Veda, which is basically animal stories. And I think it heavily inspired Rudyard Kipling's Just So stories.
Yep. Oh, yeah.
But it actually comes and may have, you know, had inspiration for Aesop's Fables and all. Mm-hmm. But it's actually an ancient Hindu script in one of the ancient Vedas. And it was basically telling people, you know, teaching children and people wisdom through these allegories using animals. And it's, you know,
that's
thousands and thousands of years old.
Do you know off the top of your head any of the wisdom that they imparted? Like any of the lessons that the stories? If not, that's fair and okay. Because it's something I'm going to look into more later. I'm just curious as to what kinds of wisdom they
would. I still have my copy of Just So Stories by Rudyard Kipling.
I have those too.
And
That's okay. Because
I was studying. I studied the Brothers Grimm for a while because I was fascinated by, and where they, you know, what people don't realize is what they were after was they basically wanted to create a German dictionary, the first great German dictionary. Mm. So they were looking up the derivations of words, and a lot of derivations of words came from old stories. Mm-hmm. So they started collecting all of these old fairy tales, and some of them were really, really, really dark.
Based on etymological research?
No, they were just looking at etymological. Yeah, Fred, that's right. I'm sorry, I thought you said etymological.
Yeah.
You know, yes, etymological research, you know, find out where this word came from. Or so they were going back, as they went farther back, they found...
It's a serendipitous...
Yeah, that all this stuff came from stories. And then so, you know, Jakob and Wilhelm, and this the stories kind of came out of that, but still in Germany, in academic Germany, they're still primarily known for creating the first great German dictionary. And in fact, the OED was created because the British were going, well, the Germans can do it. We can certainly do it. So they
So
they had to create the OED because they were embarrassed because the Germans had this great dictionary.
And by
before
OED, you mean the Oxford English Dictionary.
Yeah, the Oxford English Dictionary, the OED, right. And so that's how that came about. But then, so then the stories came out. And I found the connection into the Aesop fables. And then the farthest it could go back was the Hindu Vedas, where there's this book, mm-hmm. which has these animal stories. And in fact, some people who get into like Richard Dawkins or a few others who get into, you know, looking at the Old Testament and seeing its inspiration from other ancient texts, you know, talk about, you know, the snake in the garden is, oh yeah, that's, but that there was a snake in a garden in a Hindu text before that and this and yeah. this, you know.
I thought most of those influences are more over like the Babylonian
Mesopotamia.
Yeah,
I'm saying that this that these books
Sumerian.
Become,
yeah.
especially in the Old Testament, they become this part of this, you know, where did all these stories come from? You mm-hmm. know, because it's just, and it's fascinating. I mean, like even, because we're talking, I'll never be able to say his name.
Utnapishtim.
How did you know I was going to say that?
Yeah. Utnapishtim.
Yes, is the immortal.
It's Utnapishtim and Zaphod Beeblebrox. The two I'll never remember. And in the context, I figured you were going for Utnapishtim.
Yeah,
you are so well matched. I have never met a couple that is more meant to be together in my freaking life.
Well, that's what everybody
God.
Says. But this is the immortal man from the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And, you know, he is given eternal life so that he can save the world from a flood. Okay, and this story predates Noah.
And it's like there are parts that are almost word for word.
Including the use of the birds, which bird to send out first, for what reason and all that. Yeah. And it predates. So there's all this. There's all these texts, which are some are written in Sumerian. And we, you know, we only were able to translate it when we got, mm-hmm. you know, stones that would give us information like the Rosetta Stone. And, mm-hmm. you know, it would show us what cuneiform actually looked like and what it meant. Mm-hmm. And we go, wow, I mean, there, you know, it's... It's amazing when you start going back there and you're looking how often narrative, storytelling was used to teach. I mean, it's so important about our profession that, you know, we have, you know, we look at contemporary textbooks and all, but so much was, you know, the Greeks loved Homer so much. Mm-hmm. And they were afraid nobody was really, you know, writing it down because they didn't have a way to write it down. Everyone was remembering it word for word until somebody said, I know, why don't we invent an alphabet so we can write this down? Then we don't have to memorize it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So thanks to Homer, we have a Greek alphabet.
Yeah.
Because they wanted to write down these wonderful stories.
Now you have read and used as an example to me, and Paul, I know you have, A Hero of a Thousand Faces.
Yes. Joseph Campbell.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And that is something that Paul was familiar with prior to working with Lucas, but Lucas used really mm-hmm. as a strong teaching tool for all of his writers.
Yeah, he said, read Bettelheim, Uses of Enchantment, and read The Hero of a Thousand Faces, you know, when I went to work for him. And I said, I read it in high school, but I have my copies, so I'll read them again. So, and I did. And I don't think I'd actually read Bettelheim. But I read a lot of the stories, but at that point,
Wes, you've read them too. And the reason that I was going to ask you is what
Tower of Myth on DVD.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah,
because you're a huge lecture fan. Like you listen to those Audible mm-hmm. lectures. You actually turned me on to those. I got a catalog of them the other day.
Oh, they wonderful.
Kind of licking and going through.
Teaching
I haven't bought one yet.
Mm-hmm. Teaching
Fabulous.
Company. Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly what they are. Because you got me involved in those, and I thought, oh, I got to find one.
Oh, those are great.
Oh man.
I probably crossed the United States 100 times. Maybe I don't. Probably more than that in doing tours. And when I would just sit in the van and I was driving across country and I would always have the teaching school on.
You know what I do with that? I have like several hundred of these lecture series.
Oh, wow.
Because I've been collecting them since 98. And it's mm-hmm. like, you know, I'm addicted to them. I get almost everyone they have that mm-hmm. looks interesting. And now once they got the iPods up that were like 160 gig iPods, and I was able to fit almost all of them on there. So I put like all of my lectures on there, and I do it in random. I just created a big playlist of everything there, and it's in random. So anytime I'm like in the car, lying in bed at night or something like that, I'll put it on and I just get, just, you know, this might be a lecture about, you know, the Assyrian culture. This one might be a lecture about Victorian Britain. This one might be a lecture about, you know, Mozart, whatever. And they just sort of come in little random snippets,
which is fabulous.
It's just the most fabulous, wonderful way to get little bits and details when they start to...
One of my favorite ones is the one there on Gilgamesh, because, you know, the Victorians were one of the first, like, to really translate it, because they were the first to get the different stones which showed the multiple languages. Mm-hmm. And if you read the more contemporary translation of it, it just cracks me up, because I can just imagine Victorian sensibilities having to translate the story of how we get the noble savage out of the forest with the away from the animals. We send a temptress, and the temptress is telling Gilgamesh about all of her sexual prowess in very graphic. I can just imagine, you know, these you know, scholarly Victorian historian, you know, looking, oh my God, Gilgamesh, and my God, it's pornography.
Exactly. When they couldn't even show their ankles.
Yeah. But you had to put skirts on your piano legs.
Yes, they did. Yeah. Yes, absolutely.
Wow. I think that's hysterical.
The reason I brought all this up is because I was going to talk about storytelling and how it's kind of translated in both of your careers. I mean, clearly, Paul, you've made an entire career out of storytelling.
Right.
And it's your job to get to know these characters so intensely. Right. And Jonathan, really breaking it down, I can't think of anything you do that's not a story. I mean, everything from 20 card memory, where you talk about, and this is me parlaying into magic, you know, but where you talk about personal afflictions and you make it a very personal story, all the way to, like you said, using stories from the Twilight Zone. It's always a journey on which you're taking the audience.
Well, and we've asked this question before. Like a few weeks ago, we said, what's our favorite fairy tale? Let's ask that also.
Okay.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to break in so abruptly.
No, it's all good. It's just two completely different questions. So let's start with yours and end with mine.
No, we already went into what our favorites were. Let's ask our guests and if there's a favorite fairy tale, folk story or legend that has defined their career or
your personal philosophy or something that you're just a genuine fan of.
Well, for me, it's pretty obvious. I mean, I don't think you'd categorize it as a fairy tale, but the Arthurian legend is been, you know, it's what my last stage name is, Pendragon.
Mm-hmm. Is that why we've never really talked about how you chose that?
Oh, I knew that the Yarbrough family, my real last name, is an ancient English clan, and I never, West actually found out more about it than I ever did. My grandmother was really into it, but Wes was looking through all our papers, and then she researched it, and it's like the 11th oldest name in England. It can be traced back to about 700 BCE. No, wait, CE, sorry, Common Era, AD.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
And that was it. My grandmother, my father's mother, just found this fascinating. And so she would get me books about, you know, the history of Britain. And so as a little kid, I would get all this stuff, and I can't remember. I was probably 8 or 9 when the first time I ever read the name Pendragon.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, God, that is like the coolest name I ever heard. And then, of course, you know, I saw Sword in the Stone. And in our house, when you walk in the living room, there's this beautiful statue of Arthur pulling a sword from a stone that was given to me by two very dear friends, Misty and Paul, it's my most prized possession. And I love the stories of Merlin. I love and then what's worth thinking about the Arthurian legend is that as you grow older, you find that there are elements of it that age really, really well. Like when a kid, it's the Knights of the Round Table. Mm. As I got older, I got into Grail lore and all the Grail stories.
Yeah,
and then philosophy and the nature of history and I'll never be able to pronounce his name. The romantic
writer. Clayton de Troyes.
Yeah, de Troyes. And the way that the you know, the whole Galahad, the affair between Lancelot and Guinevere, that's like French romanticism. Mm-hmm. It didn't exist until like the last 300-400 years. Before that, that was never part of it, you know.
No, it was Gawain and the Green Man.
That's right, like Gawain and the Green Man.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's first mentioned by Nennius, who was in the history of the Britons.
Uh-huh.
And then it was repeated by the the Venerable Bede in the ecclesiastic history of the Britons. And these are, you know, this is 700, 800, 900 AD. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the stories go way back. Mm-hmm. And they just kept evolving and evolving and evolving. Mm-hmm. And so as I grew older, I found different aspects of the story mm-hmm. that spoke to me.
Uh-huh.
So it was one that grew with me.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably, you know, it's my favorite piece of myth there is, or the Arthurian legends.
It's interesting how the myths and the legends we gravitate to as children stay with us in various forms throughout our adulthood.
Yeah. Okay, Wes.
Well, mine actually, most of my favorites are from the next island over. I looked a lot into.
You were neighbors.
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time very much interested in the Celtic cultures, and you know, particularly you have to really sort them out because so many of them were written down by monks. The monks were, you know, the source of a lot of the literature in Ireland, so they're very Christianized in some ways, in subtle ways, which actually happened to the Arthurian ones as well.
That's right.
But I am very fond of the Book of Invasions and the Sons of Meal coming to, and the whole thing with Amargan the poet and you know the son of Meal who was battling the waves, and we see that actually later in history. Who was it who in Britain who jumped in and tried to fight the waves back? You know, it's very reminiscent of that.
I was just Alfred the Conqueror? No, Alfred.
Might have been.
What period?
I don't remember, but it was about that time.
Well, Alfred.
But yeah, not so much into the Tanbo Cuolnia and the Cú Chulainn stuff, but the earlier stuff.
Was that
the
Fearbog
and the Fomorians and the Tuatha Dé Danann and finally the Sons of Meal?
Yeah, it's William the Conqueror. I mean, but it's not William Conqueror. I think it's Alfred, though. I don't know that for a fact.
Yeah, it was pre-William, I think.
Yeah, it's pre-William. Alfred is pre-William, isn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure.
We have the Conqueror's 1066, the Battle of Hastings and all
that.
And Alfred is God, I wish I, now I'm going to feel like really dumb. Because he was one of my favorite, because he was the first one. You know the concept of a prestige language.
Mm-hmm.
And for throughout history, there have been these languages where if I didn't speak your language and you didn't speak my language, we both spoke this prestige language. And for a long time, it was Greek.
Oh, I see.
And then it was Latin, and then it was French.
Mm-hmm.
And so all scholars read those languages. And Alfred was the first person to go, well, what's wrong with English? And he said, okay, we're a prestige language. And you know, he tried to get...
from the time of William on, it was French.
Yeah, again, you know but mm-hmm. I love...
And Wes, do you speak French fluently?
Not fluently.
No?
Far from fluently. I speak it well enough to get along.
Okay.
And when I've spent time there, then it starts to get...
Which says a lot, because it's very difficult to get along with the French.
Yeah. Well, she's so easy to get along with.
They've always been very nice to me.
They've been very nice to me, too. I find that a complete misnomer. You know.
So how, in your opinion, we talked a lot about how the Pendragon legend and Arthurian legend has shaped your life. How have you kind of grabbed that, you know, because Paul and I have been talking a lot. One of the themes in our house lately, mm-hmm. and one of the lessons that we're kind of going through in our personal life, is one of our things that we're following is execute first and edit later. Mm-hmm. Because we both firmly believe, and you and I personally and privately over coffee and lunches and stuff have discussed that we both agree on this philosophy that you kind of write your own story.
Yeah.
You know, that you choose how your story turns out, and it's the choices you make. And
absolutely.
You know, so have you incorporated any of that mythology on a personal philosophical level, or is it just a, you know, like an aesthetic, you know, like the idea of those stories? Do you not understand what I'm asking you?
Yeah, it's. I'm not sure I completely understand what I'm asking you, but I, what I think, where I think you're going, I mean, it's all just so intertangled with there. I mean, even talking about the old Irish stuff, that actually a lot of that came later, but from the time I first learned to read, you know, all I devoured were stories of magic and, mm-hmm. you know, some sort of, you know, it was all the C.S. Lewis and the E. Nesbitt and the Edgar Evans and the L. Frank Baum and, you know, everything. And I actually refused for years to get out of the children's section of the library because I didn't think they had books like this in the adult section, you know, until they practically made me. It's like, you're too old to be, I mean, I'd read them over and over and over and over and over mm-hmm. again.
See, that's funny because when I was a kid, I read was Jules Verne, Edgar Allan Poe,
mm-hmm.
and Conan Doyle were my three favorite authors. And I never really read fairy tales. I never read
Frank somehow I'd gotten in my head that, like, if you'd mentioned science fiction to me, I thought it was all like Star Trek novelizations, which, not that there's anything wrong with Star Trek. I enjoyed Star Trek like anybody else. But it wasn't the real magic that I was looking for. And then eventually I sort of wandered into that section of the bookstore.
Well, and you as a little girl had magic in your life. I mean, you guys, your family was heavily involved with the castle, to say the least. And,
yeah.
you know, so that was, that's kind of in your blood.
Well, that was just, you know, truly magical, literally, part of my childhood. I
like
mean, it was just
magic,
you know, when I'd visit my grandfather, I'd go to this wonderful, wonderful place. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if I've ever sat there and sorted out which strands of that specifically influenced what parts. But it's just been so much a part of my worldview for so long. And, you know, it teaches you to deal with the dark things that come along by, you know, delving into them and adventuring and facing them is probably the number one lesson. You know, yeah, there are dark parts of life, but, you know, you can have some magical outgrowth from that. They're the things you can get by facing that and diving right into it, can be so worth it.
But it is affect. I mean, it does affect you. Although the concept of, we'll call it the idiot hero, who's heroic in the face of just being stupid, is never particularly attractive. The idea of being heroic for a reason, and that reason is the preservation of something else, something more important than you, something good, is very important to me.
Right.
It's something. It's noble. Mm-hmm. It's like if I really hate reality television because it's fame. For no reason that anyone could possibly imagine is worth anything. It's if I do something really stupid or say what they want me to, then I'll get on TV. And that's not why you should be well known. That isn't what it's about. There's no nobility to it. It's Schadenfreude, you know, mentality. It sickens my soul. I mean, it makes me feel. Why would people do that? Why would you submit yourself to your 15 minutes of fame is so near and dear to you that you would, you know, drop your pants in public? It's like,
I don't know.
But fiction stories are such a way that you can tell truth in a way that is acceptable to people, that they will listen to despite themselves because they don't know that's what you're doing. And you can disguise it, and you can find the truths in it, and then you'll read something that completely impacts you on, you know, just recently, or in the last years, I mean, I introduced Jonathan to the Sandman series because I've been a big Neil Gaiman fan from right now.
Well, and he's a friend of yours, too.
And there were some things in the first book in particular when Morpheus was imprisoned that just...
It was...
And he still, I mean, has this huge impact from it so much that he's become this...
It's interesting because it's weird how it did affect me. When I was trying to reform my act by myself... I had this wonderful idea, which I called metaphysics, which is basically, again, it's everything we've been talking about tonight. It was just basically playing Sherlock Holmes as a mentalist. Completely rational, because I do have OCD, and I have ADD, which means I'm obsessive, but I keep changing my mind about what.
I think we're all a little bit of that here.
That's really funny. That's a great line.
Thank you.
I'm glad you like it, because I'm sure he'll use it in your show.
I hope he does. I'm going to use it.
So, but it's... I love this hyper rational character. A lot of it's like based, like, you know, on Isaac Asimov's Harry Seldon, and I because I had OCD and because I had to deal with obsession and this thing, like the weird memory that I have. And I really do have this eidetic memory, which is very, very strange. How can I bring that to my magic? I've always wanted my magic to speak truth. Even though I'm playing fantasy, I wanted to speak truth. And so when I was younger and I was so physical and a complete romantic, I brought that to my magic. But the cerebral side of my nature was always ignored. And now, because I was single, I wanted to explore that. Mm-hmm. And by way of contrast, fell in with Misty playing my opposite number, being the completely mystical character, so that we could literally create a contrast, which I love, because I've lectured for years to magicians. When you have someone else on stage, and let's say it's an assistant, but which you're not, but if you create a character for that person, then you can have a conversation. Then there can be competition. That's called drama. That's called theater. That will raise the performance from just this exhibition of, look how great my hands are and what I can do.
As opposed to a doll walking on and on, you know, as a prop.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, which goes back into the story thing that we were talking about. Having been such a fan and consumed so many stories, you have also come to a very high level of competency in creating and telling them and inviting that audience on that hero's journey and saying, take a journey with me. Mm-hmm. And they want to come with you because they know the place you're going. They don't know where you're going, but they know it's going to be really freaking cool.
This has been another episode of Radio Rashi. If you've enjoyed this episode, let everyone know by leaving a review in the iTunes store. It's a great way to help others find us. You can also leave comments on RadioRashi.com, Facebook.com/RadioRashi, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Rashi or at Paul_Dini to leave us questions. Thanks for listening, and tell your friends.